Okay, so hi everyone. I'm Sophia. I'm one of the SAI students this year, but I'm doing the special two-year SAI program where this year I'm doing like placements in industry. So that's why I'm not there right now. So just to give you some context on where I learned this and what I'm doing, during the first term this year, I at my own pace, the 2016-2017 PSI course on many-body entanglement and tensor networks that Gifre Vidal taught when he was at PI. And here, if you're interested, you can find the PeerStar recordings. And also I've compiled some materials. I've done some Python tutorials for the course that previously were in Julia, and I'm finishing the notes, but all these diagrams, as you will see, take very long to make. So yeah, I can send this later in an email if you haven't had time to write them down. And I've included and mentioned some things regarding the material during the presentation, so people find it useful in the future. And yeah, Gifre is my current supervisor. I'm here in Santa Barbara working with him, and yeah, so he's taught me all I know, so I'll just pass it on to him if I don't say something right. Okay, so I come from this presentation, I'm mostly going to focus on this tensor network ansatz called MPS, which I think is the most intuitive, but I'll make some mentions of other architectures as well, so like I give you some motivation for why they exist. But I'm going to do this from a condensed matter perspective. So tensor networks, I think they can be understood from a mere mathematical perspective, but I'll start from a more physical point of view. So in condensed matter, we're interested in systems of many, many bodies. So to understand, I don't know, super high temperature conductivity, all these condensed matter problems, we're dealing with many bodies, and this means that the Hilbert space is the tensor product of all the spaces of all these individual particles, which all can have states D. So in a spin half system, this will be 2, so it could be up or down, and I'll stick to D equals 2 in the future. So as you can see, the dimensions of this Hilbert space grow exponentially with the system size n. So we had here n spins. I'm just going to be saying spins from now on. And our Hilbert space grows exponentially. So if d is 2, it will grow as 2 to the n. And so any wave function of the system will need 2 to the n coefficients to be represented, where this is representing the amplitude. So these are all scalars, and these are the configurations, so the basis over space, and there's 2 to the n of them. So this is bad because 2 to the n is quite large, and we're limited in the number of spins that we can represent. So yeah, we have this big problem of this exponential size of the Hilbert space. And then if we try to do certain approaches like mean field theory, perturbation theory, exact analytical solutions, or exact diagonalization, they fail or they're not very good. But condensed matter theorists have come up. Oh, sorry. Yeah. And now here I'll make an aside referring back to the course that I worked on in term one, which is that even though getting exact solutions for these systems is really difficult, there's still ways to go about it. And if you're interested in learning, you can refer to the course later on. So here I was able to diagonalize or obtain the conformal field theory data for n equals 20 spins for the Ising model. So this is something that you can still do, even though it grows exponentially, you can still get pretty good results using certain techniques. And then for this Majorana system, I was able to do n equals 500. So this is just an aside. If you're interested, this is something that you can learn on your own. But condensed matter theorists, even though this is very hard to tackle, they've come up with methods to go about it. So there's a bunch of techniques. I'll make some. So if you're interested, you can talk to a bunch of people at PI that do this. So Roger Milker's group, I know there's some people in this presentation that come from Rogers Group, I come from Rogers Group, and there's a lot of work being done in this field. And just I'll just mention that Monte Carlo methods, they work very well for bosons, but they don't work so well for fermions or frustrated systems. So these have a this sign problem. But I'm not going to talk about this in my presentation. I'll talk about tensor networks. So this is another approach to dealing with this exponentially large Hilbert space. And first, I'll introduce some tensor network notation because this will be appearing throughout the presentation a lot, but it's very simple. So basically, the legs that stick out of a circle represent the rank of that tensor. So if we have no legs sticking out, this is a scalar. One leg is a vector. Two legs is a matrix, and so on, for any general rank tensor. And so with this, we can represent different operations, like this would be a matrix times a vector, and then two matrices, and then the trace. I think you get the idea. If you have any questions through the presentation, you can just interrupt. I think I'll probably hear you. So, okay, so let's go back to our goal, which is trying to represent this wave function, which, as we said, is very large if we want to do it exactly. And we can write this wave function as a big rank n tensor using the notation that I just introduced. I'll stick to S taking value 0 or 1, so it's been half system. But this object has a size that's exponential in n. So we haven't done anything interesting now. I've just written it in a nice diagram. And so you can think of this object as some sort of, as a machine that you inputted a given configuration and you're trying to find the coefficient associated with it. And so you give it the values and then it gives you this amplitude. So say like 0.3. You just know the requirement that the amplitudes have to sum up to 1. And so with this diagram, we represented these amplitudes. And this would characterize our wave function fully. Okay. But now I'm going to now lead the way to matrix product states, which is our first tensor network ansatz. And I'm going to first show you a mathematical technique. So take our original tensor, which was had n legs, and now we reshape it into 2 legs. So this is just something you can do. Maybe it looks a bit weird, but you're allowed to do this, and it represents the same information. So now you can use the singular value decomposition, which says that any matrix M, doesn't matter if it's square or not, it can be rectangular. You can decompose it as the product of a unitary, a diagonal matrix, and another unitary. And in physics, we call this Schmidt decomposition, and which says that any state in bipartite, like any bipartite state in these two Hilbert spaces, you can write it as a linear combination of, you can express it like this, where chi is the minimum dimension of the spaces A and B. So really what you should get away from this is that the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix between these two spaces, which are P, I, A, which are the same as if you look at the reduced density matrix of B, they are the square of this Schmidt values, which form a diagonal matrix. So this is very important because now if this was representing a bipartite state and you decompose it, this is giving you, this diagonal matrix is giving you all the information about the entanglement and is characterizing the entanglement of this bipartite state. So we had reshaped our tensor into 2, so A and B, where B, I made it very thick because it's to the indices 2 through n together. And we can perform the singular value decomposition. And this will be our unitary, our diagonal matrix with the Schmidt coefficients, and then another unitary. I say unitary a bit loosely because these are rectangular, but they have a particular name, I don't remember. And so now this orange diagram matrix is giving us all the information about the entanglement of the first spin with the rest of the system. So it contains all the information about the entanglement. And we can carry on doing this. I'm gonna stop using colors and I'm gonna make them all pink. And we can do this lots of times, n minus one singular value decompositions, until we have fully decomposed our system into a matrix product state. So this is our first tensor network architecture. We've gone from a 2 to the n, so we are representing our system with a big tensor, into representing it as the product of these matrices. And this is the explicit, writing it explicitly mathematically. So as I said, this is called a matrix product state. These are actually not matrices because these are rank 3 tensors, but there are matrices once you select which for each spin, which like the configuration. Once you've chosen a configuration, these become matrices because you fixed this index, sorry. And for notation, these are called bond indices because they bond your sides together. And this you call physical index because they represent the physical part of the system. So this take this have size 2, so either 0 or 1. And this has size chi. And then this chi is determined by the rank of the Schmidt diagonal, like Schmidt matrix that has the Schmidt coefficients. Okay, so now let's think of the sizes again, because our main problem was the fact that this object was very large. And this had size that was exponential in n. And now here, let's think carefully what size
this is. Sophia, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi, we have a question.
Yeah.
Sophia, hello. Just quick question. Could you explain again where the middle legs come from? Because in my mind, you just took like a matrix, split it into 3, and you still have 2 legs on each side.
I knew someone would ask about this because I went really fast through it, but it's about reshaping your object. So yeah, here this was all clear, and now here I made this line a little bit thinner. So now you've taken this right. Can you see my cursor, by the way?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay. Oh, you've taken this index, and because we're allowed to reshape it however we want, reshaped it into 2 comma n minus 1 minus 2. Now this is the size of this, and now in order to do this SVD here, we would have to put this, reshape it into the left side, and then we will get our SVD. It's a bit complicated once I have coded it myself, and now it's clear in my head, but I think just from seeing it here, it might not be very clear, but it all involves reshaping your rank and tensors into ones that only have rank two, which is the ones only you can do in SVD2 matrices. So you're just reshaping into matrices and reshaping back.
Mm-hmm. And later we'll see why you want that third leg.
Yeah, well, you can see it now because this leg is representing the physical index. So you always want this leg to have size D in a spin half system. That would be 2. So this is representing the physical basis, right? So whether your spin is up or down.
Okay. So it's more for symbolic purposes.
Yeah. And once you've picked... So on Python, I think back of Python when I'm coding this. This is like when you index this and you say, oh, give me the 0th entry of this, that means you've picked like this spin to be down. And if you said 1 to be up, and then the rest just becomes matrices.
Okay. Yeah, that's cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So as we, where was I? Okay. So this was exponential in n, which is not great. And now, we have, let's count the size of this object. So each of this, so imagine this actually was infinite, because this just adds like a like a, is a boundary term, but these all of these have size chi I squared. Well, actually, I didn't write this right because the left might be different from the right, but let's say they're all the same. So chi I squared times d, each tensor has this size. So the size of this object will be of the order of n times d times chi max. So let's just, for the sake of like making this simple, that all the chi's are the same, so we call this chi max. So the size of this object is nd chi max. So if you notice that we've gone from something that was exponential in n from something that's linear in n. So this, something good has happened, but you might be sus and thinking that this has to, there's, unless you're a scion, there's no free lunch. So something has to have happened. And what happened is it's all boils down to what bond dimension we have obtained when we've performed our singular value decompositions. So if the rank of the Schmidt matrix, the Schmidt coefficients, is low, that means the entanglement was low between the, when we did the partition, that means this chi will remain low. However, if the entanglement is very high in our system, that means chi will, could even grow exponentially large, meaning that actually if this chi was exponentially large in n, then we haven't really done anything. So this polynomial advantage is only true if we have fixed our chi, or our chi was low with respect to the system size. So we come to this conclusion that these MPSs are very successful for low entanglement states. If you, a good way to think about it is if you take this to the extreme, and this was actually a product state, and you perform singular value decompositions, you would actually obtain, this will be, this will have dimension one. So it's like there was no leg there, and this will just be independent vectors.
We have another question.
Yeah.
Hi. So sorry, just to clarify that chi max is maximized over bipartitions of this entire tensor?
So chi max, you can either yourself choose to cap this chi max. So when you perform the SVD, you can say, you can truncate this object. And so if you're in most tensor network algorithms, we choose to truncate it, say, I don't know, let this object grow only up to size 8. So it would be an 8x8 matrix. That means your, the bond dimension of your MPS is 8. If you don't do this, as I said, if the entanglement of this object was very high, as you perform singular value decompositions, this chi, which is giving you the, is how many non-zero Schmidt values there were when you perform the decomposition. There are more non-zero values if the entanglement is high. So, and if you don't cap your chi and truncate these matrices when you perform the SVD, your this might grow exponentially, as I said. So there's no advantage.
Yeah, no, I just meant like if I had a three particle system and I labeled the subsystems, say A, B, and C. So yeah. Like first I would do the SVD between A and then the joint BC, and then I would do an SVD between B and C, and then chi max would probably be the first cut, right? Because you could do it alternatively, you know, cut C off first and then cut between A and B, but then that might give you a different chi max. Or do I have this wrong?
No, so when you perform SVD, you would regroup these together. So you would separate C and then do SVD with A, B, and C. It's a bit hard to explain by words, but actually the maximum chi, if you didn't cap your chi to a value, it would be at the center of your chain, because that's where I intuitively, I think of it as the value or the size of this bond is telling you how much information is kind of allowed to flow from, if you partition your system here, from this side to the rest of the system. So if you don't cap your chi, once again, this will be maximum in the center, because it's when your A and B systems are larger. So actually here, if you, the first SVD you perform, this only needs to be size D. Because if it's larger than D, it's like,
okay,
it's useless. You're over, what is it? Like you're overfitting.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks.
Yeah. Sorry, I've just maybe tried to introduce many things. Okay. So yeah, no free lunch. So this only works for low entanglement states, but we're lucky because it turns out that the ground states of gapped local Hamiltonians, gapped meaning there is a gap between the lowest energy state and the next lowest energy state. Local Hamiltonians means the total Hamiltonian is a sum of local terms. This could be affecting like two spins at once, three spins at once, but it's local. So it turns out the ground states of these Hamiltonians have low entanglement, in particular their area law states. And so that means when you're looking at the singular values, these are going to be decaying exponentially, and you can, by truncating your bond dimension, you're still going to get a pretty good accuracy. I actually did this myself, and with this logged access, yeah, they decay very fast. So MPSs are a very efficient representation for ground states of local Hamiltonians that are gapped. And just to mention the area law of entanglement, I don't like this name because area law only works when your system is three-dimensional. I like to think of this as the boundary law entanglement. So it says that your entanglement grows as the like one minus the dimension of the system. So for 1D system, this would be a constant. Yeah, so MPSs, because they represent 1D systems, you expect your entanglement to grow as a constant. And the intuitive way to see this, I didn't want to go into details, is if you look at the truncations you have to make when you divide your system, if you, in this case, for two sides, you would truncate in these two sides here. But if you make this subsystem larger, you're still only truncating in two places. That means the entanglement in a tensor network, you can intuitively think about it as the cuts that you're making. So in an MPS, this is always the same, it's always constant. So that's why MPSs represent area law 1D systems. I'm just running out of time a bit, so I'm just going to skip this part. And for 2D systems, we have another ansatz, which is a generalization of the matrix product state, but more rows of it. So this is representing 2D systems. Once again, the entanglement now is still area law. Area law for 2D means it grows as the perimeter with L. You can also convince yourself of this. However, the problem with, now we have a problem because to obtain any information from this architecture, the cost of this is going to grow exponentially with how big our system is. So this is where my area of research is. I just don't have much time to go into it, but this is why in 2D systems, tensor networks fail, because you need to make approximations about on the bond dimension, because otherwise it will grow exponentially and there will be no advantage. And the last one, the last ansatz I will mention, those of you who are more familiar with maybe CFT or condensed matter, you know that for the ground states of critical systems, in quantum critical systems, the area law breaks, and now we have a logarithmic correction. So it's no longer constant, it grows as log of L. So our MPSs wouldn't work anymore. We would have to let the bond dimension grow a little bit higher. So there's another ansatz called the Mera ansatz, which it looks like this. It still represents 1D systems, even though it's two-dimensional. And yeah, I have 2 minutes, but you could, if you look at this long enough, you can see that the cuts that you're making to connect, say, these two spins grows as the log of L because of the architecture of this tensor network. So yeah, as just a quick recap, I've introduced these three tensor network ansatz. For 1D, we have MPS and Mera. MPS are very good for ground states of gapped Hamiltonians. Mera are good for gapless ground states, and PEPs are good for 2D. However, we need to make approximations when we want to work with them, when we want to obtain any information about local observables, entanglement even, etc. So I hope that I haven't gone through this too fast and you've gotten something out of it. I think my punchline, I want this to be something like tensor networks are an entanglement-based ansatz for many-body wave functions. So they leverage the entanglement structure of ground states to represent wave functions more efficiently. But everything comes with a cost. So it depends on the amount of entanglement you have that this will be accurate or not.
Sophia, are there any more questions? Evan.
Great. Thank you for this talk. It made a lot of sense, actually. I was wondering if you have sort of a physical explanation for what's going on when you do this truncation on Chi. And like what I mean is, for example, if I had a maximally entangled state on my end sites, mm-hmm. but then I did like a truncation of like something much smaller than 2 to the n, like I should have been working with a maximally entangled state, but now what is the ensemble of states I'm working with? What does that look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. So yeah, if you had a maximally entangled state, the entries of this Schmidt matrix would be one over n, where n is the size. So it would be maximally entangled. So if you're truncating that, I don't know physically what it means. It just means you're losing a lot of information. You're losing as much information as you could lose if that happens. So, but yeah, physically, I can't tell you. So here, yeah, when you do the SVD, this would be the Schmidt coefficient. So random states, we know they're very entangled. Actually, if it's maximally entangled, this will be a flat line. And so if you truncate maybe here, you're losing all the right side information. So you just have if you then were to use this MPS to do anything, you would realize that it has less entanglement than the original state.
I guess that makes sense. Thanks.
Any more questions, perhaps from Zoom as well? I see we have some participants. Okay, if not, I think we can thank Sophia again.